Welcome to the Knowledge for Teachers podcast. My name is Brendan Lee, and on this podcast, I speak with researchers, teachers, and experts about what evidence-informed practice is and the nuances involved with actually implementing effective and sustainable school-based education. Before we start, I would like to acknowledge the land that we are all on today. I am on the beautiful land of the Darug and Gundungurra people in the Long Blue Mountains of New South Wales, Australia. I would like to pay respect to the elders both past, present, and emerging, who are the traditional custodians of this country. As we learn together today, I would like to extend that respect to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people listening today. This land always was and always will be the land of the First Nations people. In this episode, I speak with Rebecca Birch, who I first came across through her thought-provoking blogs. She shares her journey from a career in fashion and advertising to becoming an English teacher. Rebecca emphasizes the importance of evidence-based practice and the need for teachers to be skeptical and critical of educational trends. She also highlights the challenges of implementing explicit instruction and the need for standardized teacher preparation programs. Rebecca calls for a clear hierarchy of importance within teacher standards and the role of teacher preparation in reinforcing those standards. The conversation also touches on strategies for schools to drive improvement without waiting for systemic changes. So, here is my conversation with Rebecca Birch. Really excited to be speaking with Rebecca Birch today. She's a teacher of English and the Director of Research and Practice at a top 20 independent school in Sydney, Australia. Rebecca, I know that, like myself, you haven't followed a straightforward path to be in the position that you're in today. Are you able to tell us a bit about your journey?
Yeah, so I started in a completely different career in fashion and advertising. So I was a creative rep, so my job was to get work for stylists and photographers and people like that. So very different industry. I travelled to London to work for a few years as well as part of that job. Came back to Australia and was feeling very much like it was a bit of a young person's game, right? So I'd had a couple of kids in the UK by that point. And when I got back, I kind of realised that the hustle of, you know, kind of working for myself and being part of that world wasn't really for me. So I had a bit of an epiphany one day. I was organizing a job for Corona, you know, the beer company, right? So part of, you know, when you see those big billboards of people like sitting on beaches drinking beer, I was part of one of those jobs. And what happened was I ended up sending my producer, who was actually my neighbor as well. And I thought, if I'm sending my producer to Mexico to sit on a beach and drink beer in my place, I thought it might be time to get out of the industry. So I had a real moment of thinking, I don't think I'm keen on this anymore. I think the evidence is there. So I decided to retrain. And initially, I thought I'd retrain as an art teacher. I was really interested because of my career in visual arts. And then once I got into study, I realized that I didn't really want to help kids create anything, right? So I really enjoyed the writing and the theory and things like that, but I wasn't too keen on, you know, being in front of a class where kids might be, you know, rolling up clay into balls and throwing it on the roof. That was my high school experience anyway. So, and art's not, you know, sad as it is, it's often not the subject that kids take the most seriously. And I had been doing some electives in English and I'd been a reader my whole life. So I grew up in a kind of working class family, but my family were all readers. So I never stopped reading and I found it kind of easy to do the writing aspect of all of my courses. So I gradually changed over into English. And the other sort of thing driving that decision was that I was thinking, how can I have the biggest impact? And I think as an English teacher, again, before the teacher shortage as well, I thought that perhaps I'd have the best chance of like A, getting a job and B, having an impact through becoming an English teacher. So I had a goal to graduate and be in the classroom by 40. So I'm a late starter. I've only been teaching actually about 10 years, my 10th year of teaching. And I decided as well that I hadn't had a lot of experience in school since I was in school. So I took on work as a teacher's aide in various contexts. So I worked in regional settings, you know, that sort of one-to-one support, which, you know, I got mixed feelings about whether that has any impact or didn't when I was an aide anyway. And in things like behaviour schools, very high needs, physical disability settings as well. And also, again, to make money while I was still studying for my degree, I worked in respite with the same kids that I was teaching during the day. So I'd teach the kids during the day and then hang out with them on the weekend, you know, as part of their respite care and things like that. So it's a really varied experience, you know, kind of getting into teaching and then starting in my first job. And I ended up getting a job that had a lot of, you know, job security in the independent system. And I've been there ever since. So I've tried at various stages to get back into public, but I think it's been difficult to sort of I don't know, figure out the application system and things like that. So I think that the advantages I think working in an independent school has given me is a lot of freedom to have a viewpoint, you know, so I'm not sure if I would have gotten the same freedoms in public. You might know probably a bit more about that, but I really appreciate the kind of agency I've been given as an independent school teacher. And now I've been in independent schools the whole time, about 7 years as an English teacher, then about a year as a head of department, then I went to head of humanities in a turnaround school, which was really interesting. And now I'm at a girls' school in Sydney where I'm the director of research and practice. So I think about my job as like, how do I, you know, kind of enable good research to get in and also try to stop poor research, you know, kind of infiltrating the system, or, you know, sort of debunk a lot of those myths and things like that. And I look after all the professional learning as well.
Yeah. How did you find your transition into teaching, having, you know, a whole career beforehand? Did you think it was, there was an advantage to it, or yeah, what was your experience like?
Yeah. So I think Nate Swain actually asked me this question a couple of years ago, actually. And he said, because you came from fashion and advertising, he said, can you see through all the bullshit? And I said, I think I can. Like, I think that is a skill that I've got where I look at it from a different perspective. So I think having sort of, I don't know, like 20 years in industry has meant that I am highly skeptical. You know, so I think that looking at, I don't know, I feel like I haven't been enculturated into teaching for my whole career. So for that reason, I think I bring other perspectives to it, that I do think that I'm naturally skeptical just because I haven't spent my whole life in that particular system. And the other advantage is that I think I look at the system in a kind of holistic way. So in my current work, my work actually spans a lot of different areas of the school, because I think I've got a good sort of bird's eye view of things in the sort of greater context of, you know, education and schooling. And I think working in industry definitely helped me to kind of zoom out. You know, I think it was David DiCarvalho talks about, you know, the Google Street View versus the bird's eye view. And I think it's been good at helping me get that real bird's eye view of kind of what's going on and what should happen and what's possible. There's another small advantage that any career changer will tell you, and that's that you're sort of more believable to the kids because you're old. You know, so you get in the classroom at 40 and you're a first year out, but you look, you know, for all intents and purposes, like you've been teaching 10, 15, 20 years. So I think as a starting teacher, that was a huge advantage, is just that sort of credibility that kids give you if you're not sort of very green looking, at least.
Mm. Yeah. The other things I kind of found as well were when you have to change, you're starting again, and it's very humbling when you have to start again, you know, right at the bottom. You know, you might have been quite successful in your previous career, and then you're having to start again. I think it's a good shake up for us as people, you know, where, yeah, you've got to kind of take that beginner's perspective again. And if you have been successful, you kind of know what success feels like, what it should look like. And I think that also comes back to what you're saying before about having that, you know, that bird's eye view, and also, you know, always kind of looking at that big picture. It probably comes back to having run your own business, where you've had to take full ownership and responsibility of the things that are happening. And so you've learned throughout life that you can't rely on other people to be doing things for you and, you know, telling you what to do, and that at some stage you've got to start to take some ownership and responsibility of what you're doing. And I think, you know, when you're looking at those kind of shakers and movers in the science of learning space, generally they're people who have just gone out there and made things happen themselves, you know, and taken a bit of responsibility for, like, all right, I'm in a position that I could maybe help some other people out, and yeah, I'm going to have a crack at that. And yeah, that's probably what I can see from, you know, the impact that you've had. How did you come across the science of learning?
Well, I think that, see, this skepticism I was talking about before, it's pretty much been there all along. So when I retrained, our ed psych lectures were everything from Skinner boxes, you know, with the rats, to learning styles, and everything in between. So it's that real sort of relativism around what's relevant. You know, it's not like a hierarchy where the universities necessarily look at, well, this research is, you know, important and rigorous and established, and this is really not, or this is really something from the 70s that's to do with rats, and so we don't really need to teach students about that anymore. That sort of relevance around what's been debunked and what hasn't. Anyway, so I mean, when you're a first year, well, you haven't even graduated yet, I'm not saying that I brought any kind of innate knowledge to it, but I definitely brought a lot of skepticism that, you know, if I'm standing, you know, in a class and the teacher can't tell me what's important or what's not important or what works in the classroom and what doesn't, I'm naturally going to, you know, kind of take everything they say with a grain of salt. The other thing that happened to me early in my career was I made a really good friend at university who is my sort of partner in skepticism. And we've stayed in touch, you know, for the last 10 years. We're really good mates. And having her really helped me to sort of maintain that energy for asking questions. So my initial teacher education was, you know, fairly mediocre. And it wasn't like 100 years ago. It was reasonably recent in the scheme of things. Then I went to a school that was very much an inquiry model. So a lot of the sort of way the school was promoted was around this inquiry particular program. And I noticed that from 7 to 10, this inquiry model was the thing that everyone celebrated. But in 11 and 12, everyone really put their nose to the grindstone and pretty much taught explicitly. And over a period of years, I thought, why is it that this is all celebrated from 7 to 10? But when the stakes are high, everyone goes into their classroom and does, you know, something that's really quite, you know, kind of basic and straightforward and, you know, lots of feedback and lots of, you know, giving the kids information, not making them kind of seek out that information on their own. So in my third year of teaching, I think it was the second or third year, I got my first advanced English class. It's a high-performing school, and I thought to myself, I really want to nail this, you know, this class. I really want this class to do well. I was a bit nervous about it. And so I thought to myself, maybe for workload, I should get on this inquiry learning team. And so I actually sought out that opportunity to go into that team because I noticed that all the workload was shared among 8 people. So there was this a lot of kind of group planning and things like that. Often you'd be teaching half a grade. So you'd be teaching about sort of 80 kids and only one teacher would be required to give instruction. And, you know, in my naive days, I thought this is great because it means I can put all this energy into my explicit teaching of my, you know, advanced class and get a bit of time back by being a part of this team. Anyway, I was correct, got lots of time back, but it really reinforced to me that inquiry is something that doesn't really serve many learners. All right, so when you've got things like a lot of group work, this is before I even started investigating science of learning, because this is kind of these formative years where I'm discovering all these things. So group work, there'd be, you know, the gifted girls would be crying. Yeah, literally crying, saying, I'm carrying this group. What am I, you know, I'm carrying all these other weak students. I mean, they'd be a bit more polite than that, but they'd be literally coming to our office saying, I'm doing everything. The weak kids would just be sort of faffing around on a laptop for, you know, days at a time. And I would be delivering lessons on things like physics. Like now, if you know anything about me, you'll be quite shocked and horrified that I would teach anyone's child physics. And I was just really sort of fluffing around because all the lessons are kind of co-created, but it doesn't mean you have that expertise to deliver that lesson. So all this stuff about sort of integrated, you know, learning and cross-curricular subjects, it all sounds wonderful. And at the end, you know, usually a beautiful PowerPoint does appear that some poor gifted kid has made, you know, like working nights to get this thing done while the rest of her group struggles along. So it really cemented for me through experience, like why that wasn't a fruitful way to teach. And because I did see these two tracks of like, okay, this is the one that looks good in the marketing material, and this is the one that teachers are really doing when the stakes are high. So I got to see that. But the whole time this is sort of happening, I'm reading more, I'm immersing myself more in science of learning. I think I really didn't get to a point where I felt that was the real track for me until I went to SOLA, the first SOLA down in Melbourne. So it's the Science of Learning Leadership Accelerator. And I realized, I think, in that moment that I was kind of on my own, right? So that I'd been able to influence people around me just through force of personality and information and basically good practice. But I realized that I was going to have to really kind of carve out my own knowledge and carve out my own career and my own kind of understanding and my own interests. Because, I mean, when I went down to SOLA, this is organized by Knowledge Society for anyone who hasn't heard of it before, but I met a lot of other people like me as well, Right. And I think one of my first conversations with you actually was along similar lines, like, you know, you were sort of schlepping on your own, doing your own thing, and, you know, and sort of feeling that weight of being, you know, a sole practitioner. So there's something, what you can do about that is you can take your status as a sole practitioner and then just become a leader, right? So you can take that energy of going, why am I doing this on my own, and use it to connect with people throughout like a network, right? And then you're suddenly not on your own. You know, you're actually spreading influence and you're spreading practice and you're creating more and more of those little lone wolves in different schools who have got that similar energy and similar kind of drive to be better, you know, which I think has a value in itself, right? Is when you can spread your influence and become part of sort of, I mean, in Australia, it's a great network, so become part of something bigger. And that was the thing that I think it came out of Trisha Jha's paper was that it's really like a grassroots movement, you know, so we can have impact in schools, but we can also sort of spread this like a rhizome, you know, like a grass, you know, that sort of spreads out its little, you know, roots everywhere. And that's how you can have, you know, an impact as well as, you know, sort of working on your own great practice and developing your own knowledge.
Yeah. What's something that you changed your mind about as you dug into the research? You know, you mentioned before about how the school that you were at the time was, you know, followed that inquiry-based model, but you're probably a little bit skeptical. Was there anything like as you've kind of looked at the nuances of the science of learning and whether it's to do with, you know, English specifically or, yeah, what's something that maybe you've changed your mind about?
I think I have changed my mind about the pace of change. I think, I mean, that's sort of a more macro thing to say. Like, yeah. I've got little tiny things in my practice that I would, you know, that I've changed my mind about. But I think the main thing I've changed my mind about is what it's going to take to get people turned on to explicit practice. And that's from talking to people and hearing that real breadth of misconceptions around what it is. So I think the danger is that you want people to know that it's technical. You want people to know that it requires like a really strong knowledge foundation. But you don't want to turn people off into just trying things either. You know what I mean? So we know, say, that some practices work. And knowing why they work may or may not, you know, kind of be the deciding factor on whether they work or not. So, for example, a good example would be behavior routines. Like, we don't need to know that they connect with cognitive load theory because they just lower, you know, all the distractions in the environment. So we don't necessarily need to know that for it to work. Like, you can get kids to line up, you can have a, you know, a do now, you can have an entry routine, all those things. And so we don't need a strong science of learning foundation to put that into practice. Whereas other things like science of reading, they can have some really horrible lethal mutations. And I think I was reading one of Natalie Wexler's articles this morning, actually. It's happening throughout the world where people are feeling really kind of emotional about the importance of science of reading, but not necessarily having the knowledge around what all the different components of reading are so that kids are, you know, working on a continuum towards, you know, independence, you know, like, so away from phonics eventually and towards, you know, texts and, you know, comprehension and text structures and things like that, which are just as important. But it's, you know, it's on a continuum, but people are getting really stuck on that phonics thing. And so I think that we might be really grossly underestimating how much knowledge and retraining and expertise is going to be needed to make big changes. And I do think, I do worry that any cynics are going to be able to say, I tried it, it didn't work. That yeah. And possibly whole systems are going to be able to say that if it's not done well. And just the, well, you know, from the Canberra Goldman system, how many resources have poured into that. And it's still not like a complete project, you know, so it's kind of, that's been, what is there in their fourth year or something like that. So it's really worrying that the resources haven't been put behind it. And it's just all kind of taken on good faith that these resources and trainings are kind of rigorous and, you know, and actually in line with science of learning.
Yeah, my latest thinking around this whole change process is that if you're a professional learning provider or, you know, a school leader, you need to understand that, like, at the start, we need to start simple and shrink the change, you know, so start simple for teachers so that it doesn't overwhelm them, but know that the process is not simple, that it's complex and it requires a lot of knowledge from the people leading it. And also there needs to be a lot of accountability, a lot of support, a lot of checking for understanding, a lot of that follow-up, which is probably one of the key missing steps from a lot of these organizations that are pushing for evidence-based practice or science of learning. They're just kind of hearing about things and then wanting to put it into practice pretty much straight away without thinking that big picture and thinking about, well, what exactly do we want these techniques or these strategies, what do we want them to actually look like in the classroom, and then how are we going to support teachers in letting go of habits and now picking up new ones, with support in front of a live audience, which is those kids, how are they going to do all this? So yes, really, I find it extremely fascinating, the whole change process. And as someone that provides a lot of professional learning, I'm constantly making tweaks to how I'm providing that, because I know how difficult it is for teachers to not just take on this new knowledge, but also to actually take it on in a way where they can understand that the things that I'm saying actually requires them to make changes to what they're doing. It's not like the most common thing you hear from teachers is, oh yeah, I'm already doing that. But when you dig deeper, if you actually listen to all the aspects that I'm talking about, it's actually quite different, and it requires you to make a few shifts to what you're doing. You're probably doing aspects of it, but you're probably not doing it with it's the same level of this expectations and standards. And the most common feature is like things like pacing and how often students have opportunities to respond. If you're not kind of actually thinking about how, like, what the look fors are, I caught up with Russ Fox on the weekend, and we're talking about, if you've got that kind of list of look fors, it just helps both the teacher and the observer to actually be on the same page and know, all right, this is like at least a starting point, but also know that it's going to take more than just one opportunity to do this. They're probably going to need, at least three times before we actually start to see that habit change occurring. So really interesting. And it's nice to hear that you've changed your mind about that change process, because I think initially you're like, we need to make changes. When you come across the evidence, you're like, we've been doing things wrong for so long, we've got to make these changes. But then as you start to do things, you're like, oh, actually, can't pull back a little bit, because it's going to take a while.
It is, yeah, definitely. I think teachers with more experience, definitely a lot harder to retrain. And I've just interacted with a few teachers lately who say things like, well, that's just the way we taught in the 80s. And it's kind of, I don't know if that whole, I don't think Czech, well, look, I went to school in the 80s and I remember, yes, teachers got up the front and told you things. I do remember they did the teach first. So they definitely got up and just, kind of spoke at you for a bit, and then they skipped you straight to, right, now you do it. And so that whole, I'd say the biggest difference between what people think they do and what science of learning is that middle step of, we do, basically.
Yeah.
And I think it's the hardest part. So I teach some pre-service teachers at the moment, and that is definitely the hardest thing to get your head around. And I think the thing that comes with experience as well, of like practicing that middle step of we do, that sort of scaffolded, practice. And it's really difficult to get right. And it's really difficult also to get the volume right, the sort of amount of support you get and when to take the training wheels off. Takes a long time. Like, I've only been teaching really, truly explicitly for probably like 3-4 years. I think before that I had a vibe of like, this feels like it's the right thing to do. I'm not making students like, seek out their own information or their own skills.
Yeah.
But I think I didn't really put much structure to it, like sort of looking at someone like Anita Archer or Hollingsworth and Ibarra until a few years ago. And I don't think it was till then that I really understood that we do step, or that's that real check for understanding, where there's that onus on me to get, 80%, confirmation of understanding, and to carry the knowledge around of exactly who those three kids are that didn't get it. That's the most confronting part, is like you walk out of the classroom and you're like, I know there's three kids that probably didn't nail it the way I would like. And when you're not really checking for understanding, those three kids can stay invisible. You never have to confront those three kids.
Yeah.
When you've got, all your whiteboards, you can see it. And so you can address it, but you might know that they're not like 100% secure in their understanding. And I think that might be one of the barriers is like, you've been spending, you know, X amount of years pretending those three kids didn't really exist. And then you've got sort of 25 whiteboards up and you know exactly who those three kids are each time. And you have to do more examples, or you have to step in, or you have to give one-to-one help, or, you know, some, there are instances where the kid might never actually be like incredibly secure in that knowledge. And I think that's difficult to sort of look at whether you've taught something well or not and have to make a decision around that and teach it again.
Yeah, really interesting observation there. And I think it also comes back to that idea of how to teach like this, it is actually harder for teachers. Yeah. Like, they've got to do more, they've got to know more, they've got to be more active in their teaching. And so, yeah, like when we are comparing it to other ways of teaching, I think like, yeah, teachers do have to understand like this is going to require you to put in the hard yards and, you know, but it will be a lot more beneficial for both you and your students.
Yeah.
You recently wrote a paper for the Centre for Independent Studies titled Reimagining Teacher Professionalism, Why Standards Must Be Part of the ITE Reform. Before we really dig into it, can you just give us a bit of an overview as to where Australian education is currently at?
Yeah, so I think it's similar to what I was saying before, where we're at this real crossroads. So a lot of policy is moving in a really good direction. And I went to a few events last year with people like Eric Hanishek and Mark Scott at CIS. And what I sort of noticed was a lot of things converging at the same time. You know, so we had the TEAP report with a strong beginnings report into initial teacher education. We had a lot of system leaders who are sort of making all the right noises. Some system leaders are putting supports in place to actually act on that. We have a lot of other system leaders who are making, you know, sounds around explicit teaching. But what I noticed was that there's a big convergence of views and a real critical mass of teachers who don't necessarily know how to make those changes happen. You know, so that's got nothing to do with them as practitioners. That's got a lot to do with initial teacher education, the status quo. It's been like this for a really long time. So it's not that teachers, you know, can't do it. Of course they can do it, but whether those sort of resources are going to be redirected in the way they need to is a whole other question. So when I saw all the sort of policies start to converge, I did have that moment of like, oh no, how is this going to actually happen? So one of the things I quote in the paper is that it will take, if the initial teacher education reforms actually do happen, it'll take 28 years for those reforms to filter up, you know, so for those people to filter through the system and for their sort of, I guess, not just to filter through, but for their views to start to become the dominant views, it'll be 30 years, you know, I'll be retired by then. And so it seems like a huge kind of shift without a lot of cohesion. Right. So the other worrying factor is that the universities are saying things like, we already do that. It's exactly the same as with the teachers. We already do this. Or they're saying, don't tell us to do that. Or they're saying those two things simultaneously. You know, so it's kind of like, okay, we already do this, but also don't tell us what to do. And so I know from, this is purely anecdotal, but from hosting early career teachers and also from working in ITE that students have a very like an unsound understanding of science of learning. And I think potentially it's done in quite a tokenistic way, you know. So for example, like cognitive load theory, where you could spend a whole subject on that because it involves how you apply it to practice, you know, involves potentially every aspect of your practice, from behavior to PowerPoints to, you know, breaking down tasks and things like that. It's kind of subsumed under ed psych, which EdSight covers a lot of things. You know, it covers, you know, potentially student wellbeing, it covers motivation, things like that. So the TEAP review recommended core content, just for anyone who doesn't know, that did, you know, ask universities to teach about how the brain learns. You know, so ask universities to teach, you know, about behavior, which currently they're doing a, you know, fairly mediocre job of. It asked to, you know, look at culturally responsive teaching and adaptive teaching. So a bit of a shift away from differentiation to more adaptive practices. And the worry really is that, you know, or the question is, do universities have the expertise to make this happen? So if A, they're really, really resistant, and B, they're areas of expertise are in sort of, you know, niche sociological areas, is part of the resistance that, you know, that they can't follow through on it. Who knows? And so the way they monitor and assess whether universities are doing what they're meant to be doing in 2025 will be really crucial. It'll be really important that they get the right people looking, that they're rigorous. And then part of my paper as well was, will they reduce the requirements put up by the current standards so that universities can feasibly do core content? Because what's going to be really hard is if you have, you know, 38 or whatever standards, and then you want to put the core content on top, I think that's a real burden for universities that we want to sort of take away the roadblocks to this, not put up more.
Yeah.
So that's why I was arguing for a change to the standards. So basically, I think if we can't get ITE right, and then if we can't get the standards right, we're going to be, I think, in a holding pattern.
Yeah. For those that don't know, the TEEP report, that stands for Teacher Education Expert Panel, has a similar sort of review or report come out previously? And if so, like, what were the results of that, the impact?
Do you mean the quiet report before that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I can't remember, Jen Buckingham had this outrageous figure about how many reviews of initial teacher education.
Yeah.
So I think it was something like, was it 20 or 40? I can't remember, but it was crazy.
Yeah.
And so I do think that it's become circular until TEEP. You know, so we've got report after report saying the same thing. And I think TEEP was the first report to actually name what those practices are, you know, and even unpack them, even sort of elaborate on what they are. So it's almost like it's a ready to go document. If you wanted to reprogram initial teacher education, you could use that almost as your guide. It's referenced, you know, it's a great resource. And I think it sort of signals almost like a line in the sand where they're not just saying initial teacher education isn't any good, they're saying, well, and this is why, and this is what needs to happen next.
Yeah. Okay. So let's dig into that. So what, in an ideal world, what needs to be happening at that initial teacher education level?
Yeah. So I think that it sounds like a small thing, but I don't think it is a small thing, is that I think courses should potentially be a bit more standardized. So at the moment, if you've got a particular course coordinator, they can put their emphasis in the course in whatever area is their, you know, area of expertise and specialism. And I think that's great if you have a area of expertise that's very well aligned with something like, say, ed psych or science of reading or things like that. But if it's really at a tangent, and you want to, you know, kind of capitalize on your expertise, it might mean that you're teaching things that are not necessarily relevant to, you know, I don't mean not relevant, I mean not high utility to students of initial teacher education. So I think some kind of standardization would really help. And I know you would have seen Jen Buckingham's research as well on analyzing the courses for science of reading and what they actually contained. So some transparency about what the content is would be a great idea, because then students can actually compare. So I know that La Trobe in Victoria are getting their market share of people who want evidence-based practice in their initial teacher education. So it's a niche, and it's a niche I wish they didn't have, because this really should be every university, you know. So it's like great for them that they've got this, you know, corner on the market, but not great for everyone else who has to, you know, kind of just get what they get in their initial teacher education.
Yeah.
So I think some standardization around what it is, and I think the Strong Beginnings report will help with that. But I do think it's a matter of emphasis for the universities as well. So this is where the standards come in. So standards are written about 10 years ago. And this is sort of, just for context, it's before COVID, right? So it's the time when you might have had a late career teacher who couldn't quite use Teams, might never have heard of Zoom, might have struggled to use OneNote or Canvas or things like that. Those teachers are gone now, because they all know how to use everything. So online learning, it's not just, I think it would have happened anyway, but online learning really accelerated people's ability to use tech and the way they utilized it and the way they, I don't know, even came to rely on it. So in the standards, for example, there's three descriptors around tech, which seems like a bit sort of Y2K to me. Like, it just seems a bit sort of I don't know, like something kind of cool, hip, you know, 70-year-old, you know, person in a university would think was a cool thing to do. We've moved really well beyond that. So if you think about, if you mention IT three times, it suggests that it's, there's an emphasis on that, right? Because otherwise, why have it in three different ways across the document? And so what you can get is people whose, you know, kind of passion in a university is tech. And so they'll say, well, it's in the standards, so we're going to have a whole course on tech. We're going to have, like, I remember this is, it was 10 years ago, but I remember doing web quests.
Yeah.
Like, oh, at, for a term, like it's a whole subject. You know, so with the standards the way they are, it means that you can choose where you want to put emphasis, right? So if you're, if your thing is web quests and you've done your PhD in web quests, great, we're going to have a whole subject on that, right? You don't see many people putting their hand up to do a whole behavior subject, for example. You know, so I think the standards feed into what's happening in ITE. So they're almost like a blank slate that you can choose what to emphasize. You can even choose to have your own view on how students learn. You know, like, could you get a more open statement than know your students and how they learn? It's like, well, I don't know. You tell me, how do they learn? It's like, well, they learn by, you know, going and figuring things out for themselves. And, you know, they learn naturally. Like, we're not even really needed. We're just the guide on the side. You know, you could have any kind of view ascribed to that. So I do think that what happens in ITE is really a bit of a choose your own adventure. You know, so it's up to the universities to, you know, kind of decide. And then if you've got a set amount of people that can teach, are you sort of stuck with whatever their skill set is? I mean, I know they don't have unlimited staff just to put on. It's the same as in teaching, right? You don't have all your best teachers to put on every single class when you're doing staffing, and then have the exact same situation where they've got superstars and they've got people with extremely niche interests who are willing to make those standards bend to whatever their interests are.
Yeah. And so what evidence should inform teacher standards?
So I think that the evidence that should inform the standards is all the evidence that we would use in our practice. So the reason this, I think this paper was needed, so it came out at the same time as a paper from CIS on, you know, just what is the science of learning, which I think is a really handy, it's handy for them to come out at a similar time. And so for people like us, we immerse ourselves in this research. It doesn't need stating, but for people who are, you know, putting policy in place and who want to, you know if we're going to change, what's the next step forward, I think it is worth stating what kind of research should underpin the standards. So things, I mean, it sounds so basic when you say it, but there are people who haven't come across it yet, especially in policy, and that's things like, you know, Sweller's research on cognitive load theory. You know, and if you want to appease people, throw in some Kalyuga as well, like, and talk about how there's a point where explicit instruction doesn't work and students need to be moved on. I think things like, well, actually a lack of evidence around differentiation is probably important to sort of note, is that it's mentioned in different ways 5 times in the teacher standards. And so it really emphasizes the differences between learners instead of their similarities. So I think that's a fundamental myth that needs to be debunked. I know that there are cases, especially like, you know, in mainstream mixed ability where students can't access work, but to me that's a sign that they need tier 2 or tier 3. It's not a sign that the teacher needs to create busy work for them. It's just because they're the least capable students in a classroom and they're expected to do a little worksheet on their own. It just doesn't make any sense. You know, how are they going to progress when they're given different work at a much lower level? The tier 1 is not necessarily in place. And so things like MTSS is a good idea as well. So moving away from the things that don't have evidence and towards the things that do have evidence.
Mm. You wrote about how without a clear hierarchy of importance within the different standards or qualitative guidance, universities have been free to place their course emphasis where they choose, resulting in variable ITE provisions. What role does, you know, teacher preparation play in reinforcing the standards? So you've already spoken about some of the links, but yeah, in terms of actually reinforcing the standards, yeah, what role does teacher prep play?
So I think that it plays a huge role in who's coming through. So their actual preparation really, I think, is the difference between them succeeding or failing. You know, so for example, if you haven't really been taught anything about behaviour, and you end up in a school with high challenge. You also haven't been told anything about explicit teaching, which, you know, we know anecdotally it is linked to better behaviour from students because they feel a lot more competent and capable. Actually, the research backs that up as well, but we know anecdotally and from the research that that's the case. I think it's really setting them up for failure. But when they go into schools, I mean, at the moment, they're often told, like, forget everything you learned at university, which now is not bad advice. But in 5 years, it's going to be bad advice, hopefully. You know, if these changes take hold, then we don't want supporting teachers to say, forget everything you learned at university. We want them to say, everything you learned at university is great, and I'm so glad you did it. But is the knowledge there for mentor teachers to support early career teachers in the new practices that teachers would have learned? So that's why making sure the standards change is really important, because what could happen is we get really well-prepared teachers, but they're not necessarily supported when they get into the workforce by, you know, kind of school policies that uphold things like behaviour routines, mentors who understand science of learning and explicit instruction and can give them meaningful feedback on their practice. They might even be, you know, like I said before, told to just forget about everything they have learned. So that active pushback against whatever that teacher's practice is. You know, so prepared teachers are really important, but having them supported all the way through every career stage is, you know, possibly even more important. I mean, that's not happening. It's not happening in the way it could be now. So potentially there could be even more friction arising as a result of those kind of conflicting ideas about what good practice looks like.
Yeah, and so, you know, we've spoken a bit about that initial teacher education level. For school systems and schools that don't want to wait 30 years for improvement to happen, what can they be doing now?
Yes, I think that's a really interesting question, and I've seen a few case studies. So one of the good parts of my job is that I talk to a lot of people in a lot of different systems and hear a lot of good practice. And again, those grassroots settings are really great for meeting people and hearing about what they're doing. So I think that I remember something once that Eleanor Douglas said is that schools get PD money, and it might not be like an outrageous amount of money, but they get that money and they spend it on something. You know, so that question around what they spend it on is really important. You know, so things like a one-off session in something or other isn't going to make a big impact versus a coaching program. So I was talking to, for that particular report, I talked to David McSporran from Dundas Valley, which is, just for context, it's like a little pocket of disadvantage in a wealthier area. You know, so imagine you've got this sort of leafy northern Sydney suburb, but then with a little housing tower right in the middle of it. You know, and his school basically serves, you know, that housing tower and surrounds. So he's got a lot of students who speak English as a second language and things like that as well. So a lot of challenges there. And what I'm hearing from principals is that how you spend that staffing allocation and how you timetable and how you dedicate resources is super important. So, for example, he has been able to sort of rejig his staffing so that he can put in place an instructional coaching program. So in a way that frees up, you know, because he's got great tier one happening now through instructional coaching, it frees up a lot of sort of wages for support staff, for example, that he can then use to direct back into this release time for instructional coaching. So things like that are really valuable. I do think that if schools are struggling to kind of get started and have the expertise to, you know, kind of get going, I do think some ready-made programs are really valuable. Like I couldn't, for primary school, I couldn't tell you what they are, except that they seem to provide a sort of safety net for teachers if they're not too sure about a particular area. So I know with primary, teachers tend to specialize in literacy or numeracy. They tend to have a passion for one or the other. So those programs can be a great structure around areas they're not so confident in. And even things like the Writing Revolution. So for I think it's about $1,000 per teacher, it actually has a huge impact across multiple KLAs because they can then write in every subject, you know, and the teacher needs no skill like other than to have done this training. So I think there are really smart ways that schools can kind of direct their efforts, you know, towards a certain set of practices, you know, without necessarily spending more money than they already had in the first place. It's just about sort of how you spend it. I'm sure that everyone would like more money, but it is partly about how you spend that money. And then if you can free up things like, you know, wages, that's, imagine what a cost saving that is to not need the amount of support staff you needed before.
Yeah. So do you think it would help to have, you know, the standards kind of being linked up to professional learning providers as well? Like, I know that we can have accredited professional learning providers now, but yeah, in my experience, they're generally, because of the standards being so general, they're generally able to tick the boxes for anything in a way.
I do think that it would have to be that way. I'm not sure about whether every state needs, but I also wonder whether, you know, if you don't get that understanding of an assessor about what those, you know, say there are new standards for argument's sake, and if the assessor doesn't necessarily have that understanding of what those, you know, kind of standards actually mean, so it comes back to that knowledge piece, like, do we have the knowledge to, you know, kind of act on this stuff? So you take an initiative and you align the professional learning, accredited professional learning with standards. So yes, that would be a great move, but you've just got to make sure that people know almost like what the standards mean. So this is where that guidance comes in. So in the report, I put in some information about the UK's early career framework, and it has these really great elaborations on what each standard actually is. And it's really well researched. It's all, you know, got all the footnotes and citations and things like that. And it really shows, you know, kind of more concrete actions. You know, the standards say that they're supposed to tell us what teachers should know and be able to do. They really don't do any such thing, you know. So the UK standards kind of talk about really specific practices. So if you're doing things like adaptive teaching, what does that actually look like? It looks like, I mean, it doesn't say this, but it looks like getting up off your desk and giving someone a sentence start, you know, things like that. So it's not quite that specific, but it will go into detail about what that actually looks like. And it's not done in a prescriptive way where it's only this set of practices. It's, you know, here's 5-10 different ways that you could do this. So they're really practical. So if you're, I mean, I know they're created for early career teachers, which I think is genius, because they're the people that definitely need to have those descriptors unpacked. But I just learned the other day that AITS will do an unpacking, a guidance document for TESOL. So they have TESOL standards, and then, well, what does that look like in the TESOL classroom? Now, I haven't read them in detail. I don't know if they're actually that useful, but it's not like there's no history of that ever happening. So that's what kind of made me optimistic, because I thought, well, if you can do it for TESOL, you can do it for, you know, the graduates, the proficients, the, you know, the highly accomplished, etc. And so I think we really do need that, you know, unpacking of what those specific practices are. And I do think too, like, when you do that, you're almost providing like a little reading list library of, you know, where people can go if they want to know more. I think we've got a long way to go when it comes to bringing everyone up to a stage where they, I mean, even the core content, like, it would take a while just to get established teachers, you know, aware of what the core content is and what the theoretical foundations are. You know, like I said before, some of it matters and some doesn't matter. So, but yeah, in that space of, I'm always surprised by the kind of lethal mutations that can happen. You know, so like, even like a really simple thing like a do now, I've seen that go wrong in 10 different ways.
Yeah.
And so I think there's scope for lethal mutations of many, many kinds.
Yeah. And do you think the standards could help prevent those lethal mutations by being a bit more specific in the way that you're talking about?
Yes and no. Like, the no part of me thinks that some of it is about practice and experience and not being too dogmatic or attached to something you've heard, for example. So a good example of that might be, well, probably phonics again is a good example of that. So you hear phonics is good, and the research for a context doesn't tell you anything about dosage, or, you know, so there's still all those questions around how long in secondary, for example, like, how long should a secondary student be in like a tier 3 intervention when they're potentially missing out on curriculum? Like, there's all those questions that really almost involve, ideally, like, what you want is people who, like, several people who have shared understanding, who are making decisions on behalf of students. I think it's when you have one teacher in the classroom who's been told one little thing about practice, and then that becomes their thing that they really latch onto. So I've seen things like a do now retrieval, you know, daily review style thing in secondary might go for half an hour out of an hour lesson. And there's no one sort of saying, you know, anything specific is, and this should be marked and done by about the 10-minute mark. You know, so unless you wanted to go into that sort of real micro detail, it becomes really, you know, paradoxical, doesn't it? Because you want people to be really familiar with, you know, kind of research and practice and what they should and shouldn't be doing. But those questions around, you know, dosage, fidelity, they can't be answered in one document. It's a really difficult thing. That's why I think having a program of professional learning, the question is, how do you scale that? You know, so like it's okay for one school, you know, it's you can definitely achieve it with a great leader and, you know, a couple of key knowledgeable people. You can do it in one school. Can you do it in a whole system? I don't know. Like it becomes very, very tricky, and I don't pretend to have the answers.
Yeah. So in terms of the standards then, what, you know, ideally what could they look like? What would you like to see?
I'd probably like to see them something more like the ECF, Early Career Framework document, where people, ATSL, are not afraid of actually naming what those practices are, what they're based on, what kinds of things feed into them. I think that's the thing that's been missing, is that when the standards were invented, I think they do a really good job of sort of giving us the breadth of what teachers do. You know, so like if you look at it as a list, it's probably pretty accurate. Well, we do curriculum and we do, you know, kind of we report to parents, we engage in professional learning, we talk to other practitioners about student needs and things like that. But I think we don't really need a shopping list. We know what we do already, all right, and we try to do those to a high standard. So things like standard 6 and 7, it's like basic professionalism. You know, just as a professional in any field, these are the things you do. So sort of de-emphasizing those in initial teacher education would probably be a good idea. And really drilling down on those first 3 or 4 standards, as this is the core of what we do, and we need qualitative advice about what this actually is. You know, so things like that we need to sequence our instruction. So according to what set of rules? Like that could be really any number of things. Or I think there's one descriptor about behavior, and it's very euphemistic. It sort of dances around the fact that this might be about behavior and routines. You know, so it doesn't go into anything about, you know, consequences, consistency, routine, student learning, students actually learning those routines, none of that. It's like one little tiny thing. And if you think about early career teachers, there's a lot of research around that their sort of path to being a good teacher is it's sequential, right? So it's similar to what StepLab do, where if you don't have students' attention, you can have the most beautiful lesson plan in the world and no one's going to hear it.
Yeah.
You know, so, and things like questioning is a really advanced skill. You know, you don't have a goal of like being a better questioner as an early career teacher. It's like, can you get them sitting down, all looking in the same direction with a pen in their hand? That would be awesome. If you just do that, we're at least in the game. You know, so yeah. So things like that. I think that stating what feels obvious. I mean, this is probably part of the obstacle about why maybe they didn't go down a qualitative road in the first place, is that I agree with aspects of this, that teacher expertise is super valuable, but we're making this huge assumption that teachers have a really strong foundational understanding of why their expertise works. You know, so we've got a lot of great teachers who might not know why they're great teachers.
Yeah.
Which is great, sort of leave them alone. We've also got a ton of teachers who might be struggling and not really knowing why. Like I think that's part of why teachers drop out of teaching, because they're not seeing success. You know, so you're doing your balanced literacy and your kids are all chaotic and no one's ever said, you know, kind of given you that knowledge that, you know, let's start here and work our way towards, you know, mind-blowingly enlightening education later. You know, once we've got them all sitting down and paying attention, then we can move on to bigger things. And I do think that's why a lot of teachers drop out, because they're not seeing success.
For as little as the price of a cup of coffee each month, I would really appreciate it if you supported the Knowledge for Teachers podcast. While the podcast will always be available for free, your support will ensure the sustainability of it. By doing so, you will gain access to transcripts, my key takeaways from each episode, and more. So, if you can head to patreon.com/knowledgeforteacherspodcast, that would be greatly appreciated. If you are a larger organization interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact me at brendan@learnwithlee.net. Now, let's get back to the episode.
Putting your kind of skepticism hat on, why do you think these suggested changes wouldn't happen?
So I have been in rooms with system leaders who do not want them to happen, who for whatever reason, I can't figure out the reasons, don't feel like this is a valid pathway. The sort of, I don't know whether it's a straw man, but the reason that's given often is that teacher autonomy thing. So I think my view on autonomy is that if you are killing it in the classroom, just keep doing what you're doing. If your students are achieving outcomes, you know, you're not quite sure why, doesn't matter. You go into your classroom and you keep doing whatever that secret sauce is that you're doing. And for everyone else, it's like, well, we all want to get better, right? So whenever I say something like this, I definitely include myself in this. It's not a class I walk out of that I go, I killed it, it was great. I always walk out going, yeah, that didn't quite, not quite satisfied with how that went. So I'm not saying this from on high. I'm saying this as a practitioner in the classroom who's never happy, who always wants to be 1% better. You know, so I always try to put my money where my mouth is. So I think there are people at the system level who don't want it to happen, who are wedded to, and I also think that, well, this is almost like a side discussion, but I think that the whole holistic education, which can be faith-based, not always, but it can be sort of like an aspect of faith-based education, is a way to divert attention from whether you're meeting outcomes, right? So if you say, look, we're not educating just the brain, we're educating the whole child. Like we're educating their ability to, you know, have soft skills. It's not that I don't believe in soft skills, but it's like, how much time do you want to waste teaching people to be a nice person? You know what I mean? It's like, it's a biologically primary skill, right? And we want to make sure that all that time in schools is spent on secondary skills, or like as much as possible. So I think it becomes a way to not really confront poor outcomes is to say, well, no, we educate the whole child. We don't need to, you know, concern ourselves with things like, you know, getting them into uni courses or, you know, helping their post-school outcomes or whatever. So I think there's a sort of whole ideology wrapped up in that, I guess is what I'm trying to say, is that it's not one thing. It's like a package of things which is centered around, you know, sort of student well-being or sort of character education and a lot of warm fuzzy things that for me, look, you know, putting on my cards on the table, like huge distraction. As far as I'm concerned, a lot of that stuff is a huge distraction from the job of educating these kids so that they can, you know, get into nursing or do whatever their little hearts desire, you know. So I think there are people at the system level. I think that the universities will push back. And I don't know, I mean, my view is that it's a capacity issue dressed up as a kind of ideological resistance issue. I think they're more comfortable teaching sociology and social justice than, you know, like teaching as a craft. So if you go back a bit further, a lot of the stuff that's turned out to be incredibly useful for teachers has not come from education faculties. All right, so it's come from places like Ed Psych, it's come from the reading scientists, and not necessarily, you know, part of education faculties. And so I think protecting that niche is really, you know, important to universities, is like our brand is sociology and social justice. So I think there'll be some ideological pushback in that instance. And then I think you have the whole scale issue, which is where it's really difficult to get good professional learning and retraining happening at scale and with goodwill as well. I mean, I haven't mentioned that yet, but how do you inspire teachers with great change management to want to do this stuff? I mean, it's all well and good for me to say it's needed, or, you know, put together whatever views I have, which is, you know, with you here, unfiltered views. But at the end of the day, the human beings who need persuasion and they need data and they need, you know, safety and comfort and support and time and resources and all that kind of stuff. So I'm making it sound really impossible here. I don't think it's impossible. But I think unless you put that sort of human hat on as like, well, what do, and probably the same with universities. Like if you say, look, we're going to support you, we're going to, you know, universities potentially working together to make sure that expertise is shared. We're all working towards the same thing, which is, you know, the education of children. So making sure that people kind of get where they are in that scheme of things and aligning them to that specific purpose is a really kind of, it doesn't get enough attention, I think.
Mm. Yeah, the human aspect is incredibly important. But I guess like from another angle, do you think if we had a bit more accountability, a bit more nudging from looking over in the UK where they've got Ofsted who are kind of providing that accountability. Do you think we need a bit more of that here in Australia as well, and that could potentially speed up this process?
It used to be that way apparently, like before my time, but it used to be that NESA in New South Wales would come and inspect schools. They cut it because of costs. But it'll be similar to like almost like everything I've said to this point is, does your inspector have the expertise? So in the UK, they've had a huge cultural shift that sort of well predates our cultural shift. So they do have things like the academies increase accountability just even in an enrollment sense, right? Because they're publicly funded, but they're competing for enrollments and they can get shut down. You know, so there's that sort of almost half commercial / public funding model, which I think increases competition and accountability just on its own. That's before you get into cultural shifts around evidence-based practice. And when you do have more competition, so even though the public schools, it increases competition, theirs is a bit different because the schools are probably geographically a bit closer together as well, whereas in Australia you tend to go to the school that you can get to. It's like so geographically dispersed that you're like, well, there's a bus that goes to that school, so I guess I'm going to that school. Whereas there, I think that competition and sort of the way the country is laid out has ramped up that sort of aspect of like we're selling ourselves on great practice and great. The character comes through in, so if you've got a character program, it comes through in like places like Michaela where it's all around behavior and values and things like that. It's not an add-on. It's like part of the fabric of the school. You know, so I think our settings are quite different. I think that if you were going to have an inspectorate, it would have to be full of very aligned people who knew what to look for and weren't going to sort of gloss over, you know, things that they saw. I think, I don't know, I got mixed feelings about it. I saw Amanda Spielman was in the country about a month ago and I heard her speak, and it definitely is a double-edged sword. So it definitely can create a culture of fear and us and them as well. Yeah. I think having some rigor around how schools are inspected would help. But I know too that, say, for example, in New South Wales, NESA's looking at workload because of the teacher shortage. So they're trying to minimize, you know, interference or accountability or sort of paperwork and things like that because they're losing teachers. Like in my previous school, I said that if I ever had to go through another registration, I'd just go and get another job, you know, just because I didn't want to. I think I've been through it twice, not directly, but still it's so much work.
Yeah.
And so everything NESA is doing at the moment is about reducing that. So I think it would be something worth looking at, but I don't think it's going to happen in the immediate future.
Yeah. Looking at, I guess, the other part of our standards and accreditation, and we've got like this next level of highly accomplished teachers, what sort of changes could we potentially be making there?
So I think HALT, I'm gonna sort of put this out as a crystal ball prediction here. I think it'll be gone in 3 years. I just have this, it's not based on information, it's just based on signs pointing in a certain direction. I think it'll be gone. I hope it'll be gone. The problems with HALT at the moment is that they are based on the same standards that are very agnostic. You know, they're not making any claims about what is good or bad practice. And they expect you to be a specialist in every single descriptor. All right, so if you, for example, you might be Australia's best literacy expert. You might literally be Australia's best. Yeah. But you also have to prove your expertise in IT, right? So it doesn't make any sense to me that you would be like this jack of all trades, you know, instead of having people with specialisms where they can really be utilized, right? So the standards have literacy squished in with numeracy. There's one mention of literacy in the whole standards, and it shares a descriptor with numeracy, right? So that's the level of importance that is placed on it.
Yeah.
So you can't even be an expert in that descriptor unless you're also a numeracy expert. And so it just makes absolutely no sense that you can, like, A, I think that's been a big barrier to people getting through. I think the program's been a bit of a failure, like not there haven't been the numbers of people getting through it that they hoped for. The other thing is that there's no real roles for them. There's not really a path, like a career path for them. And I think that might be as well down to the lack of specialism. You know, so I think if you want to be, you know, expert in IT and, you know, make that work for pedagogy, then great, like, please go do that. But I don't think you should also be the school's, you know, differentiation expert and numeracy expert and so on, especially in secondary school. So I think that the program needs to, you know, either get scrapped with new standards, because I don't think you can just put an intensifier on each standard to make it, you know, like at a higher level necessarily. It's very just sort of performative, the way they've sort of made the standards just sound harder, basically. Yeah. It's like, we'll just make it sound harder and then it'll be like a higher standard. So I think that potentially if they got scrapped with any new standards, that would be a good move. And if they were allowed to specialise, similar to, say, in New South Wales, we've got the Independent Schools Association, who gives a mid-level experienced teacher. So it's between proficient and halt. And they've chosen certain descriptors that you definitely need to meet through evidence, and certain descriptors that your principal can attest that you are good at. You know, so like, I don't know, dealing with parents, your principal just checks a box and go, yep, no issues there. So there's some that are really weighty, you know, so like a set of, say, 18 that are really weighty, you have to meet them with rigorous evidence. And the rest is just a letter from the principal saying, yep, good, we trust that you're doing these things. So I think that could be one solution, is if they were going to keep the standards, you just pick an area, you know, so like it may be like a group of descriptors where you're like, okay, I'm killing it in these areas, I can be of value, because the whole point is how you're going to spread your expertise to other people. And then the rest you can elect to just have a, like, almost like a reference, sign it off. So that's what I would do. It's kind of, I've been thinking about it for a while, because they've always kind of annoyed me along with the whole rest of the standards. But yeah, I think it needs to be in the service of what schools need, not what the standards need, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, cool. Look, let's shift the conversation a little bit. An area that you've also done a lot of research on is looking at how science of learning can improve student well-being. What are some of the findings that you've found?
Yes, I've been part of a really great research project for the last year and a half with UNSW, so it's part of my master's as well. And we had a problem where we had a ton of girls applying for kind of like special provisions after the fact. You know, so they do their HSC and then they say, oh, no, I had total anxiety through that whole session and I'm going to ask for my mark to be reconsidered after that. So it's like a common practice that anyone can apply for. So anyway, the year after COVID, the school had a tripling of those applications. It's like huge. And a lot of sort of pastoral burden for the pastoral leaders to deal with this genuine, you know, anxiety around tests. They, I guess with COVID too, that made that sort of test anxiety a bit worse. So the school got a grant from the AIS to look at whether study skills could improve their well-being, right? So the project was actually around developing competence, you know, so that when they're preparing for a task, they actually know what are the effective practices to use to get through that task and actually remember things. So we didn't measure necessarily whether they did remember things. We measured their confidence in those particular strategies, and whether they felt like their competence was being satisfied, so their feeling of being able to do something, and their autonomy. So once they had felt competent, did they feel like they had a range of choices around studying that they could feasibly actually use? You know, so they kind of go together, that idea of competence. There's no good having autonomy if you don't know how to do anything. So they really go hand in hand. So we looked at those factors. Now those factors, competence and autonomy, they're three of Ryan and Desi's basic human needs. So without those basic human needs, we can't flourish, we can't grow. So they're really important to have those in place. Without those, you can't have student well-being. So we're not looking directly at subjective well-being. We're looking at sort of the factors that are going to need to be there if they're going to have good well-being. So we looked at that over a period of, I think it was going on a year, the whole program now, but our data points were taken every term, and we saw growth in their, we actually used load reduction instruction as well, so Andrew Martin's load reduction instruction model, which is a really super simplified model of instruction. It takes into account cognitive load theory, but it really strips the instruction down to its bare bones, so any teacher can, you know, adopt that. So we found that their competence was, you know, supported by that practice. They developed confidence in self-regulated learning as well, so all those practices around study skills. So the study skills were all based on, you know, Ebbinghaus's forgetting curve and John Dunlusky's research into what's, you know, what is effective versus what is comfortable, and Bjerk's research into desirable difficulty. So all founded on really good cognitive science, which we shared with the girls as well, just to give ourselves a bit of credibility. And then their autonomy was, you know, had the strongest results. So after, you know, that feeling of competence, they really did feel like they could go off and do it on their own. So we've got all this, you know, research around those measures. We've got a lot of other measures as well. But we also took some school-based data. So the project was really about how we make an impact at school. You know, so what is going to help us as teachers? What is going to help the girls? So after a year, three terms, the girls did their first exam. So the first exam block in year 10, where they hadn't done a big block before, you know, with just back-to-back exams. So over that period, we had a 45% reduction of girls in girls of concern. So like we've got a list of girls who have wellbeing issues, and some of those are labelled as like academic wellbeing issues. So 45% reduction of those particular girls, which is like amazing. Like that's the data that schools care about, right? It's not the, you know, structural equation modelling. It's all the, you know, girls that just don't appear on lists anymore. And over that same period, we had no parent phone calls of parents saying, my kid's really stressed, they don't know how to study. So we've got it, you know, down to zero phone calls during that whole period. And just bear in mind too, this was their first exam. So really like school-based data, really amazing. And their enjoyment of school went up like a crazy amount, including during the period of their exams. So we've got kind of two data sets. So I think about data and research in sort of two ways. The first way is like, you know, as researchers, are we being rigorous? You know, so is the school producing something of value, you know, that's been through the ringer on, you know, all sorts of tests of validity and things like that. And the second thing is it making an impact at the school? Like, so a teacher's fielding less phone calls, a teacher's giving out fewer tissues. Are they, you know, doing fewer meetings with girls about, you know, intervening on how to organize themselves and things like that. So there's always two tracks to these projects. And if they don't have those two tracks, I think they're not super, they're not as valuable as they could be.
Awesome. I love that, the tissue test. So can we dig into that a little bit? So how exactly were you providing these lessons? Were they like a part of, you know, say English lessons, or was it separate again? Who was running it? How long did it go for? Yeah.
So it was mostly, I think it was mostly me. And in a lecture style, so 200 kids, we've got the luxury, right, of being able to put 200 kids in a theatre and they actually listen. So I know that's not necessarily possible at every school, but we've got a high ICSEA school. Girls tend to be, I don't know, I'm just generalising here, but a bit more compliant around stuff like that. Like you can sit with them for 20 minutes. So we had 20 minutes allocated time. We developed examples. So the study skills themselves are technical enough that they do need some unpacking and explicit instruction. So things like motivation and goal setting, they don't need a ton of explicit instruction because it's fill in a form, tell us what your goals are. Things like brain dumps or writing factual or conceptual flashcards are a bit more technical and they need to be unpacked. So we had a 20-minute session once a week, usually delivered by the same person, not always, sometimes delivered by a subject matter expert. Then the girls would practice with their tutors present. So whatever, you know, application they did, they would do it in the presence of their tutors, and then they'd have little bits of homework to follow up, or things like study sessions where they'd just do application in the lead up to exams and things like that. So last year we did subject-specific examples, but almost like, I wouldn't say they're domain general skills, but they're grouped in sort of like some skills are good for humanities and some for the more science and mathematics kind of subjects. Yeah. All right. So the kind of broad domains that they're applicable to. And this year it's changed a little bit because they've got subject matter experts giving content relevant and timely application. So it's an improvement on last year, I think. So this year it'll be, okay, right now in English you're doing romanticism, so we're going to do a brain dump on romanticism. Or right now you're doing, you know, kind of introduction to physics and science, so we're going to do some conceptual flashcards for physics, you know. And it's very timely and a lot of consultation with the teachers as well. So good uptake. I mean, I think this is part of the program success as well, is that we had a good organic uptake of these practices in classes by teachers. So they're given a little bit of PD, just enough to, you know, there's a lot to sort of learn. So not so much that it would overwhelm them, but a few just easy strategies that they can do in the classroom. And I think that sort of broader uptake was really effective in the girls seeing how it actually applied in different subjects. That yeah. was like an unplanned, you know, like those lethal mutations in a good way. It was one of those. It's like, yeah. Oh, I'm glad that you're all suddenly doing this, you know, these brain dumps or these, you know, do nows or whatever. So
yeah.
it was a decision that I think created a lot of tension over the course of the project, because it is kind of boring to put 200 kids in a lecture theatre for 20 minutes. And so the kids, we do a lot of consultation around what the kids wanted, and they'd say things like, we hate it and it's boring, but we know it's good for us. And so I think when you have kids with high interjected motivation, so they're kind of like looking at what's the end goal for me, you know, like yeah. what is, you know, it's a bit like sort of I'll take this medicine because I know it's good for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have girls who can rationalize that and articulate it and go, well, it sort of fits with my broader goals of, you know, post-school goals or whatever. So they'll put up with a lot of, you know, things not being like incredibly engaging because they can step back and connect it with what they actually want to do with their lives.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, looking at how other schools could potentially use these findings, maybe if they looked at more like bite-sized, you know, metacognitive strategies being taught, you know, throughout school rather than, yeah, in this kind of one block when they're kind of getting closer to, you know, year 10 is closer to senior school than anything else. Mm-hmm. So if we had maybe like a scope and sequence where there's certain, you know, study skills which are being taught throughout high school, that could potentially be a little bit more achievable for schools that maybe don't have the capacity to do what you've done.
Yeah, so I think that Kate Jones, I think it is, has got a really great book out on retrieval. And yeah. so you can work it into your classroom activities. I think the shift would be not looking at it as extra, but if your job as a teacher is to make students remember things, then you look at multiple strategies to make that happen. So in primary school, there's a daily review. So that's built into the structure of, you know, your lessons, right? So you're actually doing these kind of skills every day anyway, whereas in high schools, it's not so much the norm. So if you do things like retrieval at the start of a lesson every day, you're taking care of that sort of daily review in a sort of more compact sense. So I think that it comes down to like teacher education is looking at your role as like the person that makes students remember things. And then it doesn't become an add-on, it becomes part of your normal practice to have an awareness around, you know, space practice and retrieval and what the benefits are, you know, just becomes part of what you do. So that's where we're really impressed by the teacher uptake of the strategies, because they happen to be a really great settling activities to do now. So we've got three campuses and the girls come in at like almost not random times, but they kind of straggle in, you know, instead of like all turning up at the door at the same time. And so having a do now where they're doing retrieval just means that your explicit start to your lesson is on time because everyone's sitting down quietly doing this retrieval activity. So I think there are ways to make it sort of like organically integrated into what we would normally do anyway. I think that's potentially like the best way to do it, because you lower the barrier to teachers actually implementing. You say, well, how's this going to work for you? So we do a bit of work with Tony Hatton Roberts as well. And part of the do nows she advises is to talk about to our departments, like, what does a do now have to look like for our subject? You know, so, and even what's the purpose of it? So if you're on a campus that's 5 minutes walk away, maybe the purpose of your do now is to have a really settled settled class when it's time to start your lesson, that everyone's sitting there ready to go. If it's mathematics, maybe it's to preload some revision that the students are going to need in their next lesson, you know, so that sort of activating schema and things like that, which is still retrieval, but it's like very purposefully designed to, you know, kind of bring in the things they're going to use in the lesson that's about to happen. So part of that buy-in is giving people plenty of agency around what they think it's for. And if it has a good purpose, then great, just do that, you know, make sure that it works for your particular subject.
Yeah. And so, you know, the main data collection it had was around student wellbeing, but did you also look at academic outcomes as well?
We didn't, and we deliberately didn't, just because it wasn't the goal of the grant either. So we could, but anecdotally, we're getting good results. So, for example, the senior classes who have put it in place are having a lot less, I mean, they're kind of connected, aren't they? Because they're having a lot, they're getting better marks and also a lot less stress. So in a girls' school, that's the big thing, is like how much stress is there in the lead up to a task. And they definitely project that onto their teachers. Then it's natural, right? They're kids. So you get this kind of like triangulation of evidence around what's effective. So I think, and I might be wrong about the data they're collecting, but Churchy up in Brisbane, they do it for academic reasons. So they've got a very similar program called the Teachers Toolkit, and they've been really great critical friends to us. And I think they look at academic data as well. Yeah. So, and again, I think with this kind of project, the rubber hits the road outside of class. So it's a difficult thing to monitor, because you've got motivation and sort of scheduling sort of attached to those practices. So it's not necessarily in our context, it's not necessarily something you can control 100% within the classroom, because the girls have to actually go off and apply it at home. So there's a big unknown around what actually happens in the home. Like, it's part of the kind of problem with research about study is that it doesn't happen in front of a researcher and it doesn't happen in the classroom. It's all like happening somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, it sounds really promising. And I guess it's another example of what the science of learning and the research can look like within an actual school setting. And the considerations that you're talking about, they are things that, school leaders and schools do have to consider and think about, like, the practicalities of, like, what could this look like at our school. And I think that's the important part as well, is just contextualizing all these different stories and bits of research so that you can make it practical and work for your context.
Yeah.
Rebecca, as we get towards the end of our conversation, yeah, it's been really fascinating. What's on the horizon for you?
Oh, that's a good question. So I am part-time in my role this year, and I have nothing planned for term two, which has never happened to me. So I've got quite a few projects wrapping up now, and then nothing planned for term two, other than my job, of course. And so I don't have a huge amount, you know, kind of projects planned for next term, but I'm speaking at Research Ed in Newcastle in, I think it's September or August, something like that. So don't worry, the date's in my diary. I will definitely turn up. And I'm doing a Science of Learning for English Teachers course with AIS, which is happening in a couple of weeks, which is really exciting, because I think that there are domain-specific elements to how we apply science of learning. I think a lot of the PD happens around primary school, and not a ton around secondary school. I think primary school really dominates there. Mm. So looking at how I can bring that to English teachers is something that I've been, you know, wanting to do for a really long time. And I'm super pleased that the AIS, the Association of Independent Schools, is going to, you know, kind of work with me and their literacy consultant, Megan Hurd, on a course that will help English teachers kind of find a way in if they haven't already.
Awesome. And then finally, what other bits of knowledge or resources would you recommend for teachers and school leaders?
So I love podcasts. I think that is a really good passive way to learn about practice. So there's a ton of really great podcasts, including yours, around. So I'd really recommend to do as much passive learning as possible, just because I know teachers are really, really busy. I've been really absorbed with my master's at the moment, so really digging into, you know, research on self-determination theory as well. I'd probably give a little shout out to Alex Quigley's blog as well. So he does a little summary of the research every week, I think it is, where he gives his favorite links, and it's a really good curated way to engage with research as well.
And he's then got some great books as well.
Yeah, yep. So I'd also, if you're just starting out on your journey, I'd probably recommend, you know, some books just about practice. So like Anita Archer or Hollingsworth and Ibarra. So I just think even from a workload perspective, I actually think reading those books saves a lot of time in a lot of ways, because you're teaching to a sort of structure and you know that you're covering, you know, what are the essential elements. So I think they're really good, almost like a scaffold for getting into explicit teaching.
Yeah, awesome. Great recommendations there. And thank you for your time today, Rebecca. I'm sure people will find this really useful. So thank you. I really enjoyed hearing Rebecca provide an overview of the state of Australian education based on her research and experiences as a practitioner. Here are my key takeaways. Having a different perspective and a holistic view of education can be advantageous for teachers. Teachers should be skeptical and critical of educational trends and focus on evidence-based practice. I liked her reflection of how it's really difficult to make effective change quickly and that we need to be aware of lethal mutations. The TEEP report is promising, but we need to ask ourselves, do we have the expertise that is needed in ITE? Standardized teaching preparation programs can help ensure consistency and quality in teacher education. Clear hierarchies of importance based on the evidence is needed within teacher standards to guide teacher preparation. Schools can make a difference by investing in coaching programs and providing ongoing support for teachers. Effective staffing allocation and instructional coaching programs can help address challenges in education. Teacher education should include more specific and qualitative standards to guide practice. The science of learning can improve student well-being and academic outcomes. A study skills program can reduce anxiety and improve student performance. Next episode, you will hear from Dr. Mark Dowley, who recently released the Classroom Management Handbook with Ollie Lovell. We unpack the key principles, tools, and routines. However, that's it from me for today. And as always, stay curious, keep learning, and teach with purpose. Bye for now.